Hi, I'm Fabi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are
Latinos Who Lunch,
the podcast where we talk about important things like
Frida por vida.
Hello, hello, hello.
Kisho, kisho, kisho.
How are you, Babelekis?
I'm super full.
Oh my gosh, we just went to one of our favorite restaurants, the original Lindo Michoacán on Desert Inn. And we had lunch with some really great friends. And here in the studio today, we have Dr. Anita Revilla. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Yes, I feel like a lot of students are going to be very excited about this episode. Your students love you. So I'm very excited. I mean, we're all very excited because we've been trying to do this for 6 months now. So it's finally happening.
I'm honored to be here. I really am.
Yes.
First of all, let's talk about what we ate, because after all, we are Latinos Who Lunch.
Indeed.
We'll let you go first.
So I had the enchiladas suizas, mm-hmm. and they were delicious. They had a really nice green salsa, very cremoso, and I always love the fideo that comes with every dish, and
yes.
I love the frijolitos that they give us with the chips.
Yes.
And of course, it was a lot of food, so we have at least one more meal to go after this with our leftovers, but it was delicious.
And they were enchiladas de pollo, right?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So good. Mm-hmm. I had carnitas, but Fabi advised me to have the carnitas de Coca-Cola. Can you explain people what that is? Because I don't know what I ate. I just know it was delicious.
Okay. This is... Okay. So I thought everybody's family put Coca-Cola in their meat to marinate it.
Uh-huh. But no.
Have you heard of that before?
I have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's. I think it's because usually they put beer... You know what I mean? To do the same thing.
We put beer in tequila.
Yeah, mm-hmm. because your family is not saved like mine. So my family is growing up a super Christian.
Uh-huh.
So instead of putting beer in our carne asada,
uh-huh.
we would put Coca-Cola. And Coca-Cola actually works as a marinade because the acid in the Coke, you know that if you pour Coca-Cola on your driveway,
mm-hmm,
it will clean the grease stains?
Hallelujah.
Because there's so much acid in it.
Hallelujah. Dangerous.
That's what we're drinking, girl. And I tried it one time in my studio. I was using a lot of the spray foam uh-huh. to like make sculptures. And a lot of my knives, like my spatulas and stuff for painting.
Se oxidan.
They were like... really caked on with all this gook.
Uh-huh.
And I just got a bottle of Coca-Cola and I put them
y
in
se
there.
Limpio.
And they cleaned.
Damn. Damn.
I like to watch the YouTubes where they teach you all the things you can clean with Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh my God.
It's
how
crazy.
Scary.
Yeah. So they put that in the meat. And then the azúcar, because of the sugar in it, mm-hmm.
It becomes like a syrup.
It caramelizes when they cook the carnita, so mm-hmm. that's what you had today.
And it had chile pasilla.
Yeah.
And pasilla goes with anything sweet. So I make these camarones with chile pasilla, a little bit of sugar. It's so good. So anything with sweet and chile pasilla, it's a perfect combination. And arroz, frijoles, y guacamole.
Yeah.
That's it. ¿Y tú qué
I had a vegetarian burrito,
ay,
but it was
siempre.
Too big, so I didn't finish it, but I saved it for later, and it was good. They had a whole vegetarian section. You know, sometimes I go to restaurants and I'm afraid that there's not going to be anything for me to eat, but you know, these people, they're holding it down.
Shout out to Linda Michoacán.
And I've noticed that whenever you go to... Depends on what city you are. Because in L.A., now everywhere has vegetarian
Everything
options.
Is vegan in L.A. now.
Yeah. The gentrifiers come in.
See?
And, you mm-hmm. know, you have a vegan burrito choice.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Let's get into it.
Yeah.
So, tell us a little bit more about yourself. What is it that you do? What are you doing in UNLV? We just know that you're doing amazing stuff. Everybody I met that is Latinx in UNLV knows who you are, and that's for a reason. So why don't we start with that?
Okay. Well, it was funny because the first time I heard about you all, somebody told me there were some queers who were doing a podcast and that they were real down. And I was like, wait a minute, why don't I know them? I've been here a long time and I don't know them. So I'm really grateful that I got to meet you all and that now here we are kicking it. But I've been in Vegas for 14 years this summer, which mm-hmm. is a long, long time. I never thought I'd be here this long. I'm from San Antonio, Texas. I was mm-hmm. born there and raised there. And then I went to grad school at UCLA and went on the market. And as some of you all know, getting a job is really hard. And there was a position. So my PhD is in education, but there was a position that focused on Chicana studies and border studies in women's studies. Oh. And so even though my PhD was in education, what I studied was Chicana Latina activism. So I kind of like became a Chicana Latina feminist scholar mm-hmm. in the field of education and then moved my way into women's studies, and I applied to women's studies, ethnic studies, and education jobs, and this was the job. Well, I got two jobs, one at Dominguez Hills and one here, and the one here basically paid me the same, but I taught a lot less, and so I had never been here. I wasn't attracted to gambling or just the Vegas, you know, kind of scene. So I had been here once with a friend whose family was big time gamblers. And I was like,
you're like, okay.
It's a little scary. So I was in LA studying Chicana activism because everybody said, if you want to study activism, go to LA.
You have to go to LA.
And sure enough, that's what happened. And it was amazing. I loved it. And so when I applied for the job here, I really was really scared because I said, what am I going to study? Like, I'm a social justice activist scholar. What will I do in Vegas? Well, much to my surprise, there's brilliant, badass activists here in Vegas who have been holding it down for a long, long time. And many of them are my former students who are now all grown up, who you've already either interviewed or met. And mm-hmm. they're basically the ones who are making the change here in Vegas. And I feel honored to have been working with them all this time. So mm-hmm. that's how I ended up in women's studies at UNLV. And I'm finishing up a term as the chair of the department. 5 years ago, they tried to get rid of women's studies, and we had to really fight wow. to basically show them that we're like the core of diversity, right? Now yeah. we're so proud of being diverse.
But this is a new thing, right?
It's very new. Yeah. And so think about it, like those budget cuts that were happening nationwide, the first people they went after were ethnic studies of and course. Women's studies. Mm-hmm. So twice we were on the chopping block, as they say, and our students protested, they did all these letters, etc. But what they realized was that they have a multicultural requirement and we teach the majority of those classes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like our scholars are the ones who have the most, you know, expertise in race, class, gender, in inequalities, social inequalities. And, mm-hmm. you know, although you have a few people doing that throughout the campus, like we have a core mass of them. And I feel like I have been part of that, building that. And I was really grateful because my boss was basically this lesbian radical woman from California who came to Vegas to build women's studies. And so she knew, because she had been living in San Jose, she's like, you know what? There are a lot of Latinos living in Vegas, and that's new. You know, back again, think 13, 14 years ago. She was like, that's new, and these students are going to need somebody at the university. And so she had the vision to hire me. And so I'm grateful that Lois is her name, that Lois thought, you know, we need a Chicana professor here. And so that's how I came to UNLV.
Yeah, because we study a little bit the history of Latinos in Nevada when we put together our tour for the Neon Museum. Mm-hmm. And we saw that in the 90s, it spiked. Mm-hmm. Our family got here in the 90s. And it was during that boom of construction. Mm-hmm. And you had all these Latinos that are coming to Nevada. And yeah, I feel like the university didn't know what to do with us. And exactly. It still doesn't know what to do with us.
It still doesn't. They're really they're reckoning with us right now.
But like you said, UNLV is one of the most diverse campuses mm-hmm. in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still the professors, of course, don't reflect that.
Exactly.
But it's changing.
A little bit. Yeah, and I think that's one of the really contentious things, right, is that right now we're technically tied for the most diverse campus in the country with Rutgers University. And what it's based on is like a balance of different kind of diversity, right? So you do have, for example, more Latino colleges, you have more Black populated colleges, like historically Black institutions, mm-hmm. but you don't have the variety. So we're both a Hispanic serving institution, we're an Asian American serving institution, yeah. and then we have a variety of different groups. And we always say, as diversity advocates, we say, well, that was not on purpose, right? UNLV didn't say, we want to become the most diverse campus in the country. They said, you know, we want to be accessible. We want, you know, to allow, you know, people in Nevada to get an education here. And even that came, you know, at a lot because of a lot of people's work to create a quality institution in Vegas. But again, they weren't ready for this population. And there's a few of us that have kind of been holding it down. And just now in the past 5 or 6 years, have we been hiring like a critical mass of faculty of color, which has really shifted what's happening. But it's still really a tiny number.
Yeah. Mm. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because you do see it in the classroom.
Yeah.
One of the things I noticed is that I started to adjust my teaching to start including the Philippines as part of the conversation on colonial art. Because one of the first times I taught Mexican art, we got into the casta system. And at the end of the semester, I had a student, a Filipino student, and she made all these connections between race disparities in the Philippines as connected to the construction of race as we know it in the colonial period.
Amazing.
And that blew my mind because I never made those connections. And it's because of that. It's when you have diverse faculty and also diverse students, that's the kind of conversations that you create.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Shout out to our Filipino primos.
Exactly.
I love them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And also, there's a lot of Hawaiians here in Las Vegas. And I feel like, you know, unidos, we can do anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's a huge population, especially because in the service industry, in the casinos, you know, most of the people working there are brown people.
Their entire casino is serving the Hawaiian community.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Shout out to Main Street Station and the California. So I know that you, I don't know if it's an alter ego, but you also go as Mujer Fiera.
That's how I met you.
Which to me, that name says a lot, but can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, when I was at UCLA, the organization that I studied, so I study student activists because I always really value the work that students do to both change their own lives and change the lives of the whole world, basically, society, the institution, etc. And so the organization that I studied at UCLA was called Raza Women. And these women were the ones who basically educated me. And they were younger than me. I was a grad student. They were undergrads. They were fierce. They were badass. They were queers. They were radical. And they were, you know, Chicana Latina feminists. And so they were the ones who basically raised my feminist and queer consciousness. And even like, you know, the queer identity was like a big issue. Like I came out as queer within that organization because of a lot of the queer politic. But that was one of the words that we used to use. Fiera, right? So there was a one of the Raza women would be like, "Ay, eres fiera," you know? And we're like, so I, you know, I'm a pocha, I'm a fourth and fifth generation Tejana, right, from Texas. And so all my Spanish I learned from my mom at my house, not from, you know, the classroom. And so I knew that fiera had like a connection to fierce, but I remember them identifying it and saying, no, it's not just fierce. It's actually like an untamable animal, right? Like you're untamable.
Oh, like ferocious.
Yeah, like ferocious. Ferocious, exactly. And so I remember even there was a whole because every conference, we would have annual conferences. So every conference, we would spend like 5-6 hours in a small room, like, you know, a tiny little room, like the office, where we're like, what's going to be our title this year? Right? Because like it was going to change the world, which of course, like that was our vision.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the titles was Mujeres Fierras, and I forget the subtitle, but it was like we had all kinds of things like Sin Pelos en la Lengua, Malcriadas y Que, you know, like there was all those were all the different titles. And so it was just such I identified it with Raza Women as well as the other word that I adopted and developed in my work, but in my identity, which is Mujerista with an X, right? So I don't know if you've seen that, but a lot of people use it. And one of the ways that the Mujeres identified it was that the X was a recognition of both their like complexity, their intersectionality, their indigenous identity, but mostly it was being both a feminist and an activist, a Chicana Latina feminist and an activist. Because so many of us, we do all different kinds of activism, right? Whether it's like out in the streets or at, you know, in your studio, right? Like that's a form of activism. You're changing mm-hmm. the world through all the work that you're doing. And so what I was trying to identify was that there are a ton of us who are mujeristas, right? Mm-hmm. Not just, I'm just not like your average Chicana Latina. I'm not your average feminist. I am a mujerista, similar to what, you know, Alice Walker coined as womanists, right? Like for Black women. Mm-hmm. And so yes. again, like pretty much all these other feminists of color have branded and identified, you know, their feminism in that way. So for me, mujerista and with an X, and then also mujer fiera, mm-hmm. I owe that to like my legacy of consciousness with raza women. And then also my third identity that yeah, I really yeah. identify with is Anzalduista because oh, of Gloria yeah. Anzaldúa, right? Yeah. So that she was the yeah. first Chicana feminist that I read, that like all of her like theories and thinking resonated with me, you know, not only because she was Tejana, because she was queer, she came from a working class background mm-hmm. and was basically surviving in academic spaces and, you know, really struggling, but also just being really fiera, right?
Like, yeah.
you know, and so I have this tattoo right here, and it's one of her quotes. It says, "Wild tongues can't be tamed," right? Mm-hmm. So you think about it, like fiera, it's all about, like, you, no matter who I am, I could be at the university, like, I'm still who I am, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to show up as authentically as possible, right? We always have to shift, and we talked about that a mm-hmm. little bit in the past. Like, we have to shift a little bit to survive in Euro-patriarchal environments.
Yeah.
But as much as possible, I want people to like look at me and say, oh no, she's not the average academic, right? She's different.
Yeah.
And so for me, identifying as mujer fiera, as mujerista, you know, now, you know, having these tattoos, mm-hmm. for me, it's like showing up in a very different way than the mm-hmm. rest of my colleagues.
Yeah.
And that's so important because so many people out there want to control our narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we are creating our own labels
mm-hmm.
and we are creating our own narrative
mm-hmm.
and we are creating our own imagen.
Exactly.
That's so important because we forgot to do that.
Exactly.
And we also we have to be strategic, but it's about us. We are the ones who make the decision on when do we get to perform the identity and for what purposes.
Exactly.
And that's so important. That's exactly. so important to have control. And that takes a long time
because exactly.
there's so many things that happen in life and we can get lost. And it's happened to all of us at some point or another.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to have these reminders that we are who we are for a reason and we're fighting what we're fighting for a reason. So
exactly.
that's amazing.
Yeah, and you know, identity is key to like all the work that I do. Obviously, I look at community and the way they self-identify. I look at, you know, the different identities that we've adopted to create coalition, to create community. And I know that my students are always like, well, I don't like to identify, right? A lot of people are just like want to reject identity. But we talk about like, you know, Black feminist work, like Audre Lorde, who's yeah. you know, talks about like, if you don't identify yourself, other people will identify you, and usually to your demise, right? Like usually to destroy who you really
yes.
are. And so I don't care how fluid your identity is, like you have to take some agency in it, right? And claim it however it is, right? Like and so that's why I'm all about like fluid identities, right? Like I could be, you know, Chicana in this space, I could be Tejana in another space,
yes,
and you know,
that's right.
And then sometimes
we are all of that.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. I love that.
Exactly.
And I said that, I made that statement when we talked at UNLV with
mm-hmm,
you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, ni de aquí ni de allá. Mm-hmm. That's bullshit. We're mm-hmm. de aquí, de allá, from here, from there.
Absolutely.
Todos lados. All of these labels.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, for example, I stayed away from identifying as Chicano because technically I'm not a Chicano,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people just put me in that because it's just easier to call me a Chicano and then put me in an art show
mm-hmm.
because that's
then
the
Central
theme.
Americano.
Exactly.
Because people are lazy curators, you know? but now I embrace the Chicano label mm-hmm. depending on who I'm
space.
With and like
yeah.
if I'm proud of the work that I'm doing and it's continuing this legacy and,
mm-hmm.
and informing people
mm-hmm.
I'm down with that right
exactly
so I love that you embrace all your labels. And another label that you mentioned already and maybe we can get into it
mm-hmm.
is your queerness.
Yes
so tell me about that.
So I love my queerness. And I love that y'all are queers. Well, you know, I think, again, people have a long time looked at queerness as what, you know, historically as deficit. But even when we have, you know, identified as queer, for example, as young people, usually it's like a very strict queerness, right? Like either gay or lesbian, etc. Mm-hmm. And so for me, most of my younger life was pretty much like I was living like a hetero. Like I actually hadn't questioned my sexuality as a young person. Mm. And it wasn't until like my mid-20s that I was hanging out with my gay friends mm-hmm. in San Antonio, going to the gay bars, allegedly as an ally. You know, I always laugh because I'm like, those queer allies, you know, like you really got to think about what draws you to being an ally. Because really, like, it's there's a comfort and an interest in sexual identity that's different than the average heteronormative person or the average homophobe, right? And so I was hanging out as a queer ally, and then this really hot woman asked me to dance. And I was like, oh my God, she's so hot! And so I always tell this story, but like I literally went home and I was like, you know, mom, like I told my mom that night at the table, I was like, mom, if I ever met a woman who I really liked, I think I would date her. And my mom was like, you know what, mija? Me too. And uh-huh. she was like, you know what? She's like, I think I married your dad because I was expected to. And now my mom identifies as bi.
Shut up.
And so what happened is there was a moment in my mind where I was like, you know what? I can have some agency in this. And that's really scary even for queer people, right? Yeah. Because we've been told, like, I have no choice. But what I always tell my students is this, is that there can be agency in your sexual identity. And maybe for some people, they didn't feel that agency, but mm-hmm. there is a sense that you can, you know, have pride and you can have strength. And you, like, for example, like me, I started out identifying first. I was like, I'm an ally. Then I was like questioning. Then I was, bi. And now sometimes I use bi because people hate the bis, and so I like to shock people.
Like, right? It's like, not real.
Like, I'm bi. You know, it's like.
You know what?
Who knows what she does? She's scary.
She can't make up her mind.
Exactly. You know, or she wants it all, right?
She wants it all. Well, I'm selfish.
Exactly, indeed. So, of course, I love to, like, play with people's, discomfort.
Yeah.
But really, I'm a big advocate of fluidity in all identities, but especially sexual identity, where I'm just like, you know, I have literally, and Raza Women, this was actually my research, and you can read it in my articles.
Yeah.
One of my articles is called Are All Raza Women Queer? And so a lot of people used to think they were queer because the people who were the leaders were queer. And then there was a bunch of hetero women, but, you know, like, everybody was cool with the queerness. But because they were so cool with the queers, everybody's like, oh, they're a bunch of lesbians.
Yeah.
And so I remember interviewing them and saying, well, what do you think about that? And so I remember one of the, we called her the Raza Woman Veterana, Gardenia. She was saying, you know what? The reason they call us queer is because we disturb their comfort. Because we're radical. Mm. We push their cultural norms. And she said, and fuck it. If that's queer, then we're queer. And she was actually queer. But what she was saying is the queer politic, right? And this was in like the late 90s, kind of, 1998. So I think, you know, again, you know, queers academics have been talking about this for a long time now. And activists have been talking about it, right? Like, what is the queer aesthetic? What's the queer politic? And where is the queer, like, fluidity? And so I learned within that organization that if you create safe space for questioning and basically for alleged heteros to come out, then all these heteros who've never questioned their sexual identity might actually start questioning.
The gay agenda!
And I know that's super scary because, of course, the reason people hate queers is because they think we're turning people queer.
Yeah.
But the truth is that there are a bunch of people who are pretending to be hetero but are really queer. And
a lot of them.
So the safer it is, right, even with legality, right, a lot of people, you know, the radical queers love to hate gay marriage. But what I say is, in the legalization of gay marriage, you have a little bit of more safety, right? Like the idea that, hey, if people discriminate against me legally, then I have some rights. And so even that creates a sense of safety to question your sexual identity and or to come out, right? And so every time I some people call me like the gay or the queer fairy, right? I'll teach a class at the beginning of the semester. It's like, I'm straight. I'm an ally.
And you're like, okay, girl, like, we'll see.
Right, we'll do that. And then we get to the queer week, you know, which is pretty much all the time. Like, I'm always talking about all of these things at the same time. But when we get to sexual identity and I talk about queerness as fluid, then all of a sudden people are like the light bulb goes on.
Yeah.
Or the permission to question their sexual identity for a bunch of heteros or bis or closeted folks starts to happen. And so it's a really beautiful thing because, again, most gays, most lesbians are like, no. Most straight folk are like, no. But there's all these people who are just like walking. Like I say they're like passing heteros.
Yeah.
Right? Like the people who passed as white, where these are passing heteros. Yeah. Right?
I love that.
And just so, like me.
Indeed. And so all of a sudden, they question. And what I really have loved to see is when people are like, yeah, I question. But you know what? I'm a hetero. I'm like, good. Because queer should not be the only ones that question their sexual identity.
Yes.
All of us should be engaging in some deep investigation about like, hey, do I really like what I like? Or is it just because my parents told me this is who I have to be? Like my mom said, I just married your dad because that's what I was expected to do.
Oof. Yeah.
But that, see, that goes down. It comes back to the same idea of having the freedom to level yourself. We are, as humans, we're complicated beings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're so complicated. And from the day you're born, your identity has been formed. And your identity has been formed not as a one single unity.
Exactly.
It's so many different things.
Exactly.
So, yes, I understand when people don't like labels, but I also like the idea of that, mm-hmm. that we, let's embrace them all. Let's mm-hmm. embrace them all because this is, especially right now, like it's a radical thing to embrace all those labels because it is important.
Totally.
I mean, yes, it will be wonderful if one day we can all hold hands, Hakuna Matata, and those are not questions, but that's not what's happening right now.
Exactly.
So we have to push.
Yeah. And I do want to honor, like, I'm sure there'll be a listener who's like, how dare she? Like, the queer, you know, experience is real. It's a struggle. And somebody shouldn't just be able to opt in. And I know that people, that's why people hate the bis, right? Because there's this.
Just make a decision already.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense of privilege. And there's a sense of privilege, which is real. That,
true.
You know, they're, and a lot of bis, people who I've, you know, organized with, people who I've worked with, often kind of default to like heteronormativity, right? And or they go back to living hetero lives when it's not necessarily, you know, I don't know, prudent to like be queer. And that is a privilege. And at the same time, mm-hmm. you know, if we weren't such a homophobic society, it would, you know, like we wouldn't have like this constant like struggle around like loving whoever you want to love, right? And so for me, love and desire should be an open thing. Like it shouldn't have to be, unless you want it to, right? But it shouldn't be forced upon you that you shouldn't be allowed to love and desire whoever the hell you want to, right?
Yeah.
That's the Janelle Monáe, like, oh, what's her identity?
Pansexual.
Yeah, but she said, whatever the fuck I want, or so it's like, again, and I think that's what young folk are doing, like pretty much everybody in my family, like, you know, my children that I'm raising, my, you know, like different people who are in my environment, like there's this understanding, like I have some freedom around my sexual identity. And I say identity, I don't say orientation, because orientation is like, oh, I just happen to like this. Identity is like, this is actually how I identify.
And
this is what I
when
claim.
People use the word lifestyle,
exactly.
I always cringe. I'm like, this is not a lifestyle, but it's like, I didn't choose this lifestyle. Mm-hmm.
And that will push it a little bit even more. Instead of talking about identity, we can talk about identification because it's a process.
Exactly.
And as you say, it's fluid and we should have the freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So we should be thinking in those terms as well.
Yeah.
That's so amazing that you bring all these questions, because we're always talking about ideas about queerness and being queer, but we never really contextualizing our identification in those terms.
I mean, I get a strong handshake from a woman and I question everything. For real.
Well, see.
Well, what just happened?
Well, that's the thing, you know? And you hear people all the time say, oh, I wish I wasn't this. And it's like, well, I wonder what that would be like if you gave yourself a little bit of freedom.
Yeah.
And I mean, earlier you did say, like, I didn't choose this, right?
Yeah.
And this is the big contention, is that gay civil rights, right, has been granted on the idea that you don't have a choice. So, in other words, they said, well, you gays, you know, like you want some rights, but, you know, I guess if you admit that you wish you were heterosexual, but you have no choice, then we'll give you the right to live, right? We'll give you the right to be. And that's not cool. It's like if we said to, you know, to people of color, like, let's say there were a bunch of people of color saying, oh, I wish I was white, you know, but I had no choice. I have to be black. I have to be brown. that's hella deficit,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
See what I'm saying? And totally. So it's like, maybe you don't even want to say it's a choice, but you can at least say, like, I have, like, I feel good about who I am, right? Yeah. Like, I don't have to be ashamed of it. And so that's one of the things I tell my students. It's like, I love when parents say, well, I love you even though you're gay, but that's deficit,
that
right?
Is deficit. That
it's
is
like, don't
deficit.
Tell me even though, you know, like say, I love you and I honor you in all the and the ways you show up, right?
And period.
Yeah,
yes.
Like gay, straight, et cetera, it doesn't matter. So again, choice is really, it's a really dangerous mm-hmm. dynamic. And I know some gays will be upset with me for even bringing up choice because they'll say, like, how dare she? Like, I didn't have that choice.
Yeah.
And I understand that not everybody has. But, you know, for some folks, Gloria Anzaldúa says, for some folks, there was a choice, right? For her, there was a choice.
Mm.
For me, I could have pretended I was a straight person. You know, I think men are hot. I liked having sex with them. I had some real relationships with them. And I connect more with the women who have been my lovers in the past, you know, 10 years or whatever, than I have with most of the men that I've dated. Usually it's because those women have a sense of gender consciousness and they're not, you know, patriarchal.
Mm.
So for me, your politics are actually more important than your genitalia. And that's radical to say,
yes.
Right? So again, it's complicated. I get it. Everybody's got their journey. But but for me, I really love the opportunity to talk about like the different paths that some of us are taking.
Oh my gosh. This is fire.
That was a lot. I don't have to go to therapy this
time. I know.
Thank you.
Take my class.
But these are such important conversations that we're not having.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like even though we probably should be having them more and more and more, at some point, I feel like we're having them less and less just because a lot of kids are born into not questioning a lot of these things because they didn't have to struggle as much as we did a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a beautiful thing. But once in a while, we have to remind them that, no, girl, it wasn't that easy. Like, it's been a struggle. It's been a fight. It's been, like, hundreds and hundreds of years. And but at the end of the day, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about it. The fact that you can do that in the classroom, it's beautiful. I try to have those conversations, and I'm going to be honest, I struggle. So
mm-hmm.
I use art
mm-hmm.
as a conduit for it. And
mm-hmm.
many times I just plant a seed.
Exactly.
And it's at the end of the semester, as you say, when they're like, they connect all the dots,
mm-hmm.
and that's when they come to you and say, Professor, I cannot sleep at night. I'm like, good.
Good.
Yes. That's because that's the idea, and that's one of my goals. What you do is one of my goals with my career, to
mm-hmm.
radicalize my classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a process, but I love that you do that. I love that you do that. So what are some of the, ¿cómo se dice? Like, pushback that you've had with actual students?
Oh.
So I guess what I was thinking, first of all, was that I do have a freedom that a lot of people don't, right? To be a women's studies scholar, to be a feminist studies scholar, even in ethnic studies, but even ethnic studies is not always as open around, you know, mm-hmm. queer and gender issues. So I have to acknowledge, like, I was trained in education, but I purposely and consciously chose a field that would give me the freedom to talk about, like, these deep, controversial, you know, social justice issues. So I have a freedom that you don't have in art, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or in political science or in a traditional field of education. And because everybody expects their women's studies professor to be a lesbian, right? So, so it's like, oh, you're not? Oh my gosh. You know? Like,
yeah.
So again, I want to honor that, and I want to acknowledge that, like, feminist, you know, activism, both, you know, in and outside of the institution, has led to a freedom that I have had here. And it's very different than a lot of other faculty. But students, I'll say back 13 years ago, I had a lot of more homophobic students. I had people who just thought racism didn't exist anymore, right? That was pre-Obama. So they're they're like, oh, those are the old days. And they would literally say these articles that were written in like the early 2000s. Oh, you know, like these are already, you know, outdated. But one, I would say like the historical context is important. And two, it's still happening. And I had to like kind of unpack it for them. And then they would come around. So I had, for example, very conservative Christian students who, you know, would struggle with some of what I was saying. But by the end of the semester would say, you know, really what you're, and this is what I would tell them. We, for too long, we've looked at these issues from, you know, political party perspectives. And it's not about every political party. It's about social justice. Do you want to end discrimination or do you want to continue discrimination? Right. And so the more I say that, the more I contextualize it, the less pushback I get. But I'll tell you now, 13, 14 years later, students are completely different. They're very open-minded.
It is so different.
They're really, you know, like they're willing to engage. And you still have, you know, conservative students. And sometimes now I think you have like, they're actually a minority and they do feel, you know, a numerical minority, but politically they have power. But they do feel like they've used the language against us in terms of feeling like a quote minority, but they're misusing it, right? And so they're saying like, oh, I can't voice my opinion because I'm a, you know, because I hate gays, you know. They're not saying they hate gays, but because I'm conservative. Conservative is basically code word for I'm anti-gay, sometimes I'm anti-black, sometimes I'm anti-people of color, anti-women, etc. And so those folks exist, but they feel very victimized. And so that's the pushback that you get. I haven't had that as much because, again, what I try to talk about is social justice, not your political party, right? So it's like you might be calling it conservatism, but really what you're talking about is racism versus anti-racism. And so what I say to them is, if you're really not a racist, prove to me, kind of show me or talk to me about what anti-racist practices you're engaging in, right? You can't just say I'm not a racist and not be a racist.
Because that's easy to say.
You actually have to be fighting against it because it's so ingrained in our society.
Yeah,
correct.
Right? And so I break all of that down and I actually don't feel a lot of pushback. I feel like even my most resistant students, the worst that happens is they write a bad eval for me.
Yeah.
Like, oh, she was too liberal. But again, it's like it's like literally what you're telling me when you're saying she's too liberal is you're saying she's fighting too much for social justice and it makes me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if you think that's true, then I'm okay with that. Because it's not just liberal. It really, I really am committed to ending discrimination. And I do that through my studies, through my research, and through my teaching.
I just want to thank you for all the work that you do because we have a mutual friend, Lance Smith.
Yes.
And he's been on the podcast
he's
several
times. He's very lovely.
And he actually went through, I'm just going to spill all his tea right now. He went through a tough time in college.
Totally.
I remember, especially when it came to coming to terms with his queerness. And I don't think he felt that he could come to his friends to talk. And he went to you. And because he saw that. You're mujer fiera, right? Like you, you are kind of like a rock for a lot of people at the university.
And it's palpable.
Yeah.
It is palpable.
Like I would see you around, and I wouldn't approach you, not because I was afraid of you, but just because I had like reverence. You know what I mean? And I was like, someday we'll be friends.
Aww.
But it'll be, you know, it'll be on different terms. I just don't want to be like, hey.
An organic.
But yeah.
But now I'm the fangirl.
I know. The tables have turned.
Yay.
Well, speaking of fangirl, I want to get into something a little bit more controversial.
Oh, more controversial.
A person that we're both fans of and maybe somebody else isn't.
Let's do this.
Oh, my God.
Let's get into Frida.
Hashtag don't you dare.
Because Babelito has publicly talked about Frida in a different way.
How dare you?
On Latinos Who Lunch. And I know that you are a big Frida. I'm a big Frida fan because I'm looking at this beautiful tattoo you have that's like photorealistic. Oh my God, amazing. Done by a Cuban artist right here in Las Vegas. So beautiful.
At Basilica Tattooed, Latino owned.
So, Babelito, in the case of Frida Kahlo,
let's start with our guest.
Versus America.
No, let's start with Babelito. Okay. You first.
I never claimed to. You know, people start using me as the authority on Frida.
Ah.
I am not an authority on Frida. I am very critical of the image and what people have done with her image right now, which is very different to say, I I reject everything that she's done, because I was attracted to Frida in the beginning because I saw a picture of her with her family and she was in a suit.
Yeah.
That was my first attraction to her.
Yeah.
And she also, the way that she collected ex votos. And I always say that her ex voto paintings are amazing. Mm-hmm. My problem with Frida has been because I have looked from the 16th century onwards, I've looked at the way that the Europeans have looked at the Americas and Mexico specifically. And because of many reasons, including this horrible artist called André Breton, we have this fantasy of Mexico being this surrealist place where anything could happen. And it's still today, people travel to Mexico looking for that fantasy. Mm. And people do not, when they look at Frida paintings, they do not contextualize the realities of our country because we're a complicated society. We're a racist society. We're a poor society. We're a rich society. We're a European society. We're everything. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, because of the history of the way that the white world, including the U.S. and Europe, has constructed Mexico, and that's in all of visual culture, from the maps that were first created in the 15th and 16th century, all the way to Los Tres Caballeros that we talked about here, that's the fantasy that they want to live. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't changed. And that's what bugs me, that people will look at an image of Frida Kahlo and think, that's Mexico. Mm-hmm. And that's not it. And that's why I have such pushback for the image of Frida, because in my eyes and because of the work, for example, that I do in Mexico, I see all these gringos, man. Mm-hmm. All these gringos that just want to live that Frida fantasy. And it just drives me bananas. That's my main beef.
No, that makes total sense. And I've also heard, you know, the critique that, you know, because Frida is so prevalent in people's imaginary about, you know, either Mexican or Chicana, you know, even though, like, she's not Chicana, like, Chicanx folks have claimed her, Latinx folks have claimed her. And sadly, you know, like, white folk have claimed her, have co-opted her. And so I hear all of that. She's been commercialized and as a communist, you know, like, that she would take, you know, issue with that. And so I hear all of the critiques, and what people say is that because she's so prevalent, we don't know all of the artists. And of course, I'm sitting at the table with like two fabulous artists and art historian, you know, it's like, I understand that work, her work and the way that she's been claimed, like, it basically invisibilizes both the reality of Mexico and many other artists. And so I get that. What I go back to is just what honor and like sense of connection and identity she offers to little brown folk.
We all start with Frida. That's something that we can add in that. We all start with Frida, yes.
All over the country, if not all over the world. I mean, I was an undergraduate student, so I grew up very poor. My family continues to live in poverty in San Antonio. And so I went to an Ivy League school. I went to Princeton. Mm-hmm. It was very elitist, very racist, very classist, very sexist, very homophobic. And the people who saved my life there, who were my lifeline, were other activists. People who were like, fuck this, you know, we're like going to claim this elitist space and we're going to make it our own. And I went to these two Puerto Rican guys. They were we had minority affairs advisors, which is dorky, but they were like resident advisors for students of color. And one was named Eddie G and the other one was Eddie O. Shout out to both of them, you know, Puerto Ricans. And there was a Frida calendar on the wall. It was the first time I had ever seen her. Mm-hmm. And I looked at this woman and there was something that just like captured me, right? Like it, like people say now, it shook me, right?
Completamente shook.
I was shooken. you know, and she had that facial hair.
Yeah.
She had this intense gaze, right? You see it in the tattoo. You see like her pain, but you also see her pride, her resilience. And she had, you know, the indigenous aesthetic. And I was like, who is this? Like, I was literally like really shook by her presence. And from that moment on, and I always say like Frida has been my longest love affair, right? Like I have loved her deeply ever since 1991 when I first saw her. And so much of what I grew up in San Antonio, if there's a lot of internalized hatred in Texas and all over the country, but in Texas it's real deep because of, you know, the deep racism in Texas. I grew up not proud of being Mexicana, right? I was a Tex-Mex, you know, Tejana. Yeah. And I grew up using the word Hispanic and not being proud of speaking Spanish, not necessarily saying Anita, but, you know, Anita sometimes, right? And so that brings a lot of shame to my, like, back, to, like, my history. But it was all that internalized hatred that even my own family, who used to call Mexicanos, wetbacks, right? Mm-hmm. So it was intense. It wasn't until I went to Princeton, of all places, that I heard a little Latina from East LA say, I'm proud to be Mexican. Mexico lives in my heart. And I was like, oh, shit. I've never met somebody that proud of me. Like, so how sad is it that you live in a town that's 70 to 80% Mexicano, and you've never heard somebody speak with that kind of pride? Mm-hmm. So people don't realize what that's like. But when I saw Frida, there was like something healed my little heart, right? Like my little broken Tex-Mex heart, right? And it said, you can be who you are. Like you can love yourself. You can love your facial hair. You can love your brownness. Yeah. You can love your Mexicanas. Even all the pain that you have been through, because my family had been through a lot of pain. My father, you know, had died when I was 7. He was an alcoholic. He had, you know, been through a lot of abuse and poverty, violence, etc. And I continued to go through all that and still went to this elite school. Mm-hmm. So like me, there are a few people in those spaces. Like me, there are a few people even at the university. And so for me, Frida still represents that moment when I said, it's okay. Like, I see myself. Like, she was like, mm-hmm. you are, you know, like, you can see yourself in my eyes. Mm-hmm. And so for me, my favorite Frida pieces are not her paintings. Mm-hmm. They're her photographs. Mm. So mostly those are the ones that, like, you go to my house, I have Frida everywhere. And people are like, don't you think you're overdoing Frida? And I'm like, no, I don't. I think that Frida represents all of the wounding that we have survived, and all of the possibility of the ways that we can show up who we really are and still be proud of who we are.
And that's why you said earlier about wearing your identity, but different aspects of it, it's so important mm-hmm. in creating our own labels, because the problem is that sometimes we think we have that one icon, right?
Yeah.
But when we go to other schools,
exactly,
we realize that there's like tons of people that are doing radical and amazing stuff.
Exactly.
And that's something that we need to understand, because they're just like, there's people like Frida, they're fierce women in Central America, exactly. and South America.
Exactly.
I always think of Violeta Parra. Every time we talked about Frida, we always talk about Violeta Parra, because Violeta Parra was somebody from she's an indigenous artist from Chile mm-hmm. who fought everything, and she played her indigenismo mm-hmm. to her own terms. So she said, I'm going to show at the Louvre. So she goes and knocks at the door of the Louvre and said, I want to show my paintings here. And the Louvre is like, okay, girl, let's do it. And she was always fighting with song, with paintings and everything. So we have a lot of those figures. So I do understand what it represents, because mm-hmm. what it represents to you, mm-hmm. at one point it represented to me.
Totally.
But I also think that for us as Latinx people, we also, like you say, like, we need to understand that there's a lot of people behind us, mm-hmm. our ancestors, that have done so much amazing work.
Totally.
And I think that your dislike for Frida comes from, like you just explained, the people around her that shape her into things that she's not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I also find it very interesting, because there's a lot of artists that are male that people do that with. And they're treated very different, right? So, for example, I always kind of equate Frida. You can't really equate her to anybody, but like, I look at people like Andy Warhol mm-hmm. and Frida, and I feel like Andy Warhol is always labeled as this eccentric genius, mm-hmm. and like Frida is always highlighted as like this person that went through a lot of trauma and survived. Like, her story is of survival a lot mm-hmm. of times, mm-hmm. and I think that Frida was playing everybody just like Andy Warhol. Like, she knew, look at the photographs. She knew that she was fucking with identity and fucking with everybody's perception mm-hmm. of what she was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So her in men's suits, then her dressed up in her, and los huipiles of her servants, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Then to her completely changing her look by the end, there was this distinct Frida character
that
she made up.
It was a performance.
And it was a, she was a performance artist. And I want to give her credit for that because to me, that is so inspiring to be that aware of your identity and how important that is. Think about her back in those days, like going to Paris and showing all over Europe. You know what I mean?
That's true.
Not everybody had that access, and Frida did. And even though her life was fucked up and traumatic because of the abusive husband she had,
and that's
she still worked the system and did it in a very smart and strategic way that I don't think a lot of people give her credit. Because Andy Warhol said un pedo, and it's fucking genius. Oh, you know what God. I mean? And then you look at Frida, and a lot of people just focus
on the tragedy. That's what they do with women artists throughout art history. Yeah, the women artists
and people
that we,
of color.
Yeah, the women artists that we know today, some of the most prominent one, it's because of their tragedy. And it's so annoying. Artemisia Gentileschi is one of them. She was raped by the father's friend. And that's all art history talks about. And every painting that she does, she takes men, she takes all these themes of the Bible and she twists them and she makes something completely different. But art history always has a way to say it's because she was raped. Always, because we're obsessed with, when it comes to minorities, we're obsessed with the tragic biography.
Well, we should say the white art world.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why my students know that I hate art history. And I say that in the beginning of the class because they're like, what? I'm taking art history from a person that hates art history? And by the end of the semester, they already understand why. Yeah, because it's because of that. And that comes with its so many problems with that.
Totally.
Yeah, and there's a lot of facets and there's a lot of perspectives of it that unfortunately, because we concentrate on the tragedy, that we don't see that.
That makes sense.
We tend to not see that. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you know, she was a queer.
Yeah.
You know, she was, you know, an activist. And, you know, again, people can contest to what extent, but I'm, you know, all about like redefining activism and talking about like her art as activism, the internal, you know, activism of like being committed to shifting people's gaze, to challenging people's discrimination, et cetera. And just like being kind of fluid, right? And then also, I mean, I know that we love to hate Diego, but I think, you know, she had agency in that relationship. Like, she knew it was an open relationship. And in that moment in time, to have an open relationship was so dramatic, right? But she, you know, I think what Diego did is that he was unethical in the open relationship, right? She was like, you took it too far. Like, you know, there was parts of this that I could be okay with. But literally, like, you just didn't know how to, like, do this, like, with respect and ethics.
There wasn't an online support group at the time.
Yeah, she was like, where is the ethical slut, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the mujerista ethical slut, right? Like, that's what we really need to talk about is that, you know, because people are like, oh, he's a cheater. It's like, well, they engaged in an open relationship.
They both did,
And yet he did it in a way that violated a sense of trust and a boundary that she had created, you know, whether spoken or unspoken. And that's why they broke up. But yet her agency and her desire to, like, honor that love is what led her to, I imagine, to be back with him, right? And the thing is, people want to trivialize that and look at it as a pure tragedy and she's a pure victim. But I don't think it's that simple. Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, Diego acted in ways that betrayed her. And she also made decisions and had pleasurable sexual desire, you know, experiences with other people in very, you know, positive and, you know, like, you know, again, full agency in the way that she engaged in her sexual desire.
Yeah.
So. And there's also, they're not independent entities.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just Frida and Diego, nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many people doing so many things that help to construct the legacy of both Frida and Diego, but because of our obsession with the tragedy and the story and the love story, we erase that.
Mm-hmm.
I always think of a queer artist that always gets erased from the equation is Roberto Montenegro.
Mm-hmm.
Roberto Montenegro put together the first exhibition of popular art, and all the modernists went crazy for it.
Mm-hmm.
And Roberto Montenegro was a closeted gay, and he was part of a group of other queer artists in Mexico who are doing paintings where they're hiding, for example, valeros in the paintings as symbols of anal sex.
What are valeros?
Valeros is a Mexican toy. Google it, Luca. Oh, yeah. It's too complicated to explain.
It's and, the thing with the trompo, like the mm-hmm. that
see,
you toss
how do you,
up.
How do you say it in English?
It's like a ring toss thing, but mm-hmm. it's like connected to
the little wood piece.
Oh, I know exactly.
Yeah.
What you're
mm-hmm. about. So. And there's so many different conversations because Mexico in the 1930s and 1940s is this incredible place, right? Not only happening in painting, in murals, but it's also happening in cinema. And those images are being exported around the world and are doing some amazing things and also some many dangerous things. But that's my problem, that mm-hmm. we focus on those two.
And that's why I say I really wish I could take a class with you, because I mean, and this is why the importance of Latinx studies, of ethnic studies, of gender and sexuality studies. Like, people are like, well, you know, like, oh, those are just like, you know, you wanted to study yourself. Well, no, there's this rich history and yeah. there's a rich contemporary experience connected to these folks, and you're not going to learn about them in the traditional mainstream classes.
You're not.
And so that's why we need these classes desperately, and that's why I'm trying to build it, you know, for the past 14 years and continue to do that work.
Interdisciplinary.
At UNLV. Yeah. Exactly.
Yes. That's another thing where mm-hmm. like us as professors, it's our job to push our students to go to other departments. Mm-hmm. When I was a student, when a grad student, and I took classes in continental philosophy just to learn that continental philosophy is all bullshit, mm-hmm. but that was my professors pushing me, like, go take a class mm-hmm. on Husserl and go take a class on Kant mm-hmm. and then come back. And then we'll look, you know.
Totally.
But you have to do that because sometimes certain disciplines, they se encarcelan mm-hmm. on each other mm-hmm. and then we don't have the big picture. So it's important for us to do that.
Totally.
And for students to realize, especially right now, because students come to school woke already, right?
Yeah, they're learning on the internet.
And then if we use that wokeness and we foster that wokeness with some badass history... Mm-hmm. I mean, the world will be ours.
I love it. I love it. I love being able to talk about feminism on day one, and people already have. I mean, a lot of times there's all the stereotypes, but there's some real sophisticated, engaged folks who are like, actually, there are different strands of feminism. Like, yes. Not all feminism is XYZ, right? And one of the things that I tell students is like, we like to say white feminism versus, let's say, women of color feminism or intersectional feminism.
Womanist, yeah.
Those are true, but white feminists? There's a variety of them, right?
Yeah.
There are so many different, you know, different types and different strands of feminism, like Marxist feminism, right? Ecofeminism. And again, some of these, many of these women of color have been part of. So I always say, like, you could hate white feminism, or you could say, I don't like it when, you know, feminists who are white don't look at intersectional perspectives, or
that's
who,
different,
you know, yes. or you know, basically racist white feminist practices, right? And so, like, that's real. Mm-hmm. Racist white feminist practices are real,
as
but not
to all,
all
white feminists.
Exactly,
yes.
Because there are some mm-hmm. white feminists that have, you know, contributed to some of the ways that we understand our work, and we've contributed to their work. It's been in conversation, mm-hmm. and I think one of the things, because whiteness is so toxic and so dangerous, and it wounds us, like, we're hella wounded by white folk, right? And so it gets harder and harder to do work with them. But yet, as a teacher, I know I have some badass students. My students of color are badass, but some of them have internalized hatred. My white students, some of them are hella clueless, and some of them are hella woke and good and really engaged and committed to talking yeah. about these things. So I always say it's like it's something that we have to be in conversation with. Otherwise, we're going to constantly be in that wounded fighting space, right? Instead of trying to heal, like, our society, which really, like, we've got a lot of problems.
And we had a conversation like this not too long ago in the podcast. I said I want to be, at least myself, I want to be careful the way I throw the word whiteness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just did it right now, mm-hmm. like not too long ago, mm-hmm. because I feel like we miss those gray areas mm-hmm. where there's a lot of things happening in between, and we just keep saying white people this, white people that, but the reality is that it's a lot more complicated. And when we do that, again, Andrew Lord, the tools of the master will never dismantle the master's
mm-hmm.
house.
So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And on that note, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back with recommendations.
All right, y'all. How's it going? As you heard in a previous episode, Babelito and I are going to be in Atlanta, Georgia with Gift. They're presenting the 7th biennial Money for Our Movements, a social justice fundraising conference, July 27th to the 29th at Georgia State University, again in Atlanta, Georgia. Please join us. Register for the conference today. Babelito and I will be emceeing the entire thing, and we are so excited. Again, money for our movements, a social justice fundraising conference. For more information, go to grassrootsfundraising.org.
And we're back.
Show.
It's that time again.
Hi, you want to start? Who wants to start?
Recommendations. This is the part of the show where we give shout outs and recommend some things. You want me to go first?
Go for it, girl.
Okay. So, you know, I'm always listening to podcasts, and I really haven't gotten to the groove yet because usually I listen to like 10 a day while I'm making paintings or working. You know, it just keeps my mind occupied while I work so I don't go crazy. And so I have my top three on loop right now. And that's kind of what I listen to when they come out. And it's kind of fitting today because my top three right now podcasts are Tea with Queen and Jay. And they're two womanist race nerds. And I love listening to them because they teach me so much every time I listen. And one of the biggest things is to be careful of how you label somebody or what you call them when you meet somebody. So one thing that I've learned, especially from Jay, is she doesn't like to be called a lady. She is a woman, right? Mm-hmm. She's not a girl either, right? So now I'm more conscious of when I say, hey, guys, or hey,
I always say it, and I always like, why do I say it?
Or like, hey, ladies, or hey, kids. Yeah. Like, that's very, words mean things, right?
Yeah.
And they're very aware of the vocabulary that they use, and also what they call people. Because like we're talking about, it's kind of dangerous to identify somebody without actually talking to them first. So Tea with Queen and Jay, I love them. I never miss an episode. Also, Bag Ladies, I love them so much. I also, I learned my Corento Eventos, they call it, their current events. and also just to hear Afro-Latina voices is so awesome.
Yes.
And then, of course, Inner Ho Uprising is one of my favorite. And it's five hosts, but they kind of switch on and off. Four or five, I think it's four. And right now they're doing a series on polyamory. Oh, by the time this comes out, it'll be in the past. Okay. But I'm learning so much about open relationships and just having multiple partners and stuff. It's very taboo, especially, you know, we're talking about it in the Latinx community, Latino community. So, yeah, those are my suggestions. So, Tea with Queen and Jay, Bag Ladies with a Z, and Inner Ho Uprising.
Yes. Awesome.
I love it.
So I want to give a shout out to a guest here in the studio.
Ooh!
Vero Garcia.
Yes.
Yay.
She gave me a really good recommendation about a grassroots association that it's in Atlanta, and they do amazing work. They are Song, S-O-N-G, Southerners on New Ground. And I'm just going to read you a little bit of the description to tell you. It's very important because the kind of work they're doing, it's of resistance, and it's just, especially in the southern states. But let me read it a little bit. So, Song builds a beloved community of LGBTQ people in the South who are ready and willing to do our part to challenge oppression in order to bring about liberation for all people. We develop leadership, build our own membership base, and identify and carry out community organizing projects and campaigns. All of our work strives to bring together marginalized communities to work towards justice and liberation for all people. We tend to generalize a lot of these social justice movements, but the reality is that sometimes they're contingent according to geography. So the problems that people, the LGBTQ community, are dealing with in the South are so different than what we're doing here in Vegas or in LA or in the East Coast. So again, the community, the group is called Song, Southerners of New Ground, on New Ground, and you can find them in southernersonnewground.org. Check them out, support them. If you're in Atlanta, show your support.
Awesome.
Your turn.
My turn. So I definitely want to give a shout out to my department. Yes. I am at UNLV. And again, UNLV is doing a lot of work to, you know, try to like get with this, you know, get in alignment with our diversity experience. But I think what I want to note is that the Department of Interdisciplinary Gender and Ethnic Studies has a really badass critical mass of scholars, critical mass of students who are doing amazing work. And so just another thing that we, you know, we're trying to build Latinx studies, Latin American studies is there, Asian and Asian American studies, African American studies, American Indian and Indigenous studies, and gender and sexuality studies. And so people don't really know that this exists a lot of times at UNLV. So I just want to make sure that people know we're there, that I'm, you know, I have an open door policy for my classes. So you don't even have to enroll. If you want to check out a class, if you want to see what it's like to be a student at UNLV or my class, email me, talk to me, let me know that you're interested, and I can, you know, welcome you into a class and you can come check it out. Also, one of my colleagues wants to create a podcast on campus for our department. So Mark Badungpad's going to do that. And then two of our students already created a video vlog podcast called the Mujerista Collective. Yes. And so they're going to continue working on that. So that's Desiree y Briseida. And so I'm looking forward to them. They're, you know, they're taking their time. They've graduated recently, and so they're still working on this project, but I'm really excited to see what they do with it. So check out the Mujerista Collective.
Awesome. So at lunch today, though, I just want to touch on this a little bit. Mm-hmm. You're giving Babelito some great advice. Babelito just got his PhD, Dr. Babelito. He's shortly going to move to Chicago because he got a nice gig there.
Ooh, congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. We gave him some hot tips. And I think there's a lot of academics that listen to this, or people that are getting their PhDs. Shout out to Academic Mommy.
Hey, girl.
And so one of the things that you were telling Babelito is about like knowing your worth kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And can you get into that just a little bit?
Sure.
And some advice for anybody that's on the job hunt, basically.
Yeah, no, and what I was asking him is what did he negotiate for when he got the job? And he, you know,
I was like, girl, I was just so happy to get that job, I didn't even think about that.
He was joking, but at the same time, it's true. Like we're you know, again, for those of us who are first generation academics, there's several things that we struggle with, but one of the things is an imposter syndrome, right? Thinking that people are going to figure out that I'm not as brilliant as they think I am, but we are, right? We're not only brilliant, but we're valuable, we're worthy, we're like contributing to these spaces in ways that people have never known, right? And so I always tell my students, especially this, because it's like, if you didn't grow up privileged, maybe you didn't have access to like private schools, but everything that they know, we can learn it. But everything that we know, they can't learn it.
Oh, mm-hmm.
You see? Because the things that we've been through, the things that we've overcome, they've never had to. And unless you have to, like you don't have that, right? And so we can master art history, and we can go at it and critique it because we have a deeper knowledge, for example, of white supremacy, of colonization, etc. Uh-huh. And not everybody has that la facultad, right?
Yes.
Gloria Anzaldúa talks about. But the whole thing about knowing your value is don't just take a job and be grateful que they let the little brown person into the university, right? Instead, say, I am valuable and I'm entitled to this job. I'm grateful, yes, but I also want to be, you know, honored with the basically either the monetary, you know, value that you're giving your white, faculty, and or like with your research funds, your startup funds. A lot of people don't even know they can ask for startup funds. They can ask for lower class, you know, lower course loads.
Yeah.
You can ask for more money to move because we're moving across the country. Many of us have never moved before, never hired a moving company, you know, and so there's all of these things that multi-generation academics, their parents could have taught them, right, or their mentors teach them how to very strategically ask for what they need, but we have not had that experience necessarily.
We're not trained like
that. We're not trained to do that.
Sometimes in these Ivy League schools, that you take classes for that.
Well, the thing is, like, they don't have to because they've been doing it, right? It's part of their it's their generational entitlement and their generational knowledge, and we don't have that. And more than that, we don't always value who we are, right? Like, we're just so you know, wounded by academia, that the fact that we have a job sometimes lets us say, you know, like, or says, like, I finally made it. Like, I finally, like, this validates who I am. And so I think coming at it in terms of a space of value as opposed to a space of wounding is, it will allow you to say, like, I actually do deserve to get paid what my other peers are being paid, whether my other colleagues are getting paid. And do the not, you know, do, like, be willing to ask. A lot of my, you know, either peers or mentees, they were like, oh, I didn't even know I could do that. Well, you got to ask. And we're afraid to ask about money. And so that's one of the things that we have to kind of overcome is that fear of learning, you know, by asking and admitting. I actually don't know what the average professor gets paid here or the average professor can ask for when they're getting hired.
Yeah. And that's so important because we get so many listeners with those questions and those struggles. Like, do I belong in this space to begin with?
Exactly.
And if I do, what am I supposed to do? How much am I supposed to ask for?
Exactly.
So, yeah, that, thank you for that advice, because it's invaluable. I think us as Latinos who launch and also us in our independent careers, we've been learning the tough way.
Exactly.
We do something and then we realize that we should have done it for a lot more, for example.
On a personal note, like, as an artist, I do a lot of installation work.
Exactly.
And aquí me estoy matando, you know, doing this work. And it's that mentality that I have that has been ingrained in me because both sides of my family have worked in casinos my whole life. Mm-hmm. And they're like, take the gig no matter what.
Yeah, no seas malagradecido, yes.
And so now I'm thinking, like, and this is only through art, asking my artist friends, my white artist friends, to be honest, how much did you get paid to do that? You got paid that a day? An hour? Oh my God, you know? And so now I know for my health, like, next time maybe don't take the gig. Ask for twice as much as you were asking for, because that's what you deserve to get paid.
And somebody will pay it.
And somebody will eventually pay it. And it's so crazy. Like, that's the advice I give a lot of artists. Like, get your rate and keep it there. And people will pay that rate. And then once you get too busy with that rate, raise it. You know what I mean? And talk to other artists, talk to other people, and don't be afraid to talk about it. A lot of times it's like, oh, you can't talk about money. And I'm like, girl, you know how much rich people talk about money
all the time.
That's how they know what to do.
Yeah. And then, of course, like, you know, both the research and our experience shows that faculty of color, artists, community workers, we do more work than the average folk, right? Because our commitment is to our community, to our students. And so we end up doing all this emotional labor, especially women, also queer folk and folk of color, is we end up, you know, not only teaching, we don't just show up to teach, but we show up to do some really transformational work with our students and our colleagues. And so, you know, again, that's not necessarily going to be valued. It's not factored into your salary. So you have to think about what am I going to do when I show up, and how can that be honored with the, you know, with basically everything that I need to, like, provide for. Like, I take care of my family with my salary. So my salary is really important. Like, my, you know, multiple people in my family depend
on that.
on my livelihood, on my money, basically.
This is excellent. I feel like we started to learn that with Irene Mata, but, like, this puts it all together.
Yeah.
Shout out Irene, who showed us our worth without asking. It's so beautiful.
Yes.
And yes.
And thank you. And
I was gonna both.
Yeah. No. Let me talk. So, no, thank you. Because for a while we were like, well, fuck. Does Las Vegas even care about us? Does, you know what I mean? Because we were getting gigs all over the country before UNLV hit us up. But then, of course, once you found out, once, you know...
You were the first one.
But that's also something that I want to point out, is because Babelito and I made a conscious decision to be present at UNLV events. And so we started going, and that's when we physically saw you.
That's true.
And we're like, hey, when's Latinos Who Lunch coming to the campus? We're like, let's do it.
Yeah.
So it shows that if you support your local organizations, they will find out about you, you know? So.
And one last shout out. Can you talk about, for a second, because we're running out of time, about AJAS? I forgot to ask you about it. Because through that organization, you know Juan Fernandez, which we love, a friend of the podcast, Yosimar, and all these people around the country that we in a way, are connected as well, but through the podcast. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I've been in the field of Chicanx studies, Chicano-Chicana studies, for, you know, at least 20-plus years now. And so I started going to NOCS, which is the National Association for Chicano and Chicana Studies, back in 1998. And, you know, it was a really wonderful space. And there was a lot of, you know, Chicano scholars, Chicano students, some Chicano activists, community workers. But what we realized was that there was bunches of queers, bunches of feminists that, you know, we were there, we were present, and sometimes we experienced some sexism, some homophobia, etc. But mainly we also wanted a space that catered to what we did. So there's another organization called MOX, which is Mujeres Activas en Letras y Cambio Social, and, you know, another really wonderful Chicana Latina organization. Yeah. They're having their conference this summer in August in El Paso, actually. But there was the Jotos from the Joto Caucus, and then there was the Queer Mujeres from the, they call them the LBMTs, Lesbian Bi Mujeres and Trans Caucus. So we have our little caucuses, but we're like, you know what? We queers are doing some fabulous things. And so the queers were like, hey, that's, can we have a conference?
Yes.
And so this happened in 2007. I was a brand new professor here, but I hosted the first Joto Caucus conference.
In UNLV.
At UNLV.
Hey.
Wow.
And so your other guest, Juanito, some other people who you haven't met yet, who are brilliant, amazing feminists, you know, queers, they hosted that conference. And we were like, this is something big. You know, not only is it similar to these other organizations, but it's, you know, it's centralizing queerness, it's centralizing jotería, right, comunidad, artists, activists, and scholars. Not just scholars, but really bringing all three of those. So we would actually love to connect you to AJAS. It's called the Association for Jotería, Arts, Activism, and Scholarship.
Oh my God.
And so we have a conference every 2 years. We'll have one in next year, basically, in, I think we're going to have it in Oregon. And so we would love to have you all. I'll definitely share more information about that. But
yes,
I was the co-chair of that organization for like 6 years. It was a long time. But now we have new co-chairs, one that lives in Phoenix, Giovanni, and then and Eddie, who's up in Oregon now, and he's also from LA. Anyway, they're brilliant, amazing people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your other guest, Julio Salgado, his art has been featured by, you know, in our conferences as well. Yosima Reyes, who I love and who is, you know, one of my favorite.
I just saw him buying tacos.
He's
Saturday.
One of my favorite víboras. He's a víbora. He loves to be sassy and, you know, just his Undocu Joy, you know, movement. Anyway, we all know these brilliant, amazing people.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I remember somebody telling me about you all, and I'm like, how the hell don't I know them? So I was like, no, this is not gonna happen. And I'm so grateful that your brilliance, your love, your passion has filtered into my life. I'm honored.
Oh,
okay. And I feel really, you know, just special to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being on Latinos Who Lunch.
And this,
we really are so grateful for
and
your
let
time.
This be the first out of many collaborations,
because yes.
Even though I'm gonna be gone for a little bit,
we'll bring it
home
back.
Is Vegas is
yes.
home. And hopefully we'll do a lot of things together.
I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome.
And as always, you can visit us at latinoswholunch.com. Send us emails at asklwlpod@gmail.com. If you have a moment, go on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcast and leave us a review of 5 stars.
5 stars solamente.
Because the more reviews we have, the more represented we are. And
representational is essential.
Representation, girl.
You fucked it up.
Today's episode was produced by Justin Favela and Emmanuel Ortega. Our intern is Cara Lagunas. Marketing help from Hector Aguilar. Our music is from the band Brownout. I'm Fabi Fab.
And I'm Babelito.
Bye.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.
Bye.